Okay, tonight I want to jump ahead a little bit so we don't get Psalm to death too much in the same area. And for several reasons, I'd like to skip ahead to the Song of Solomon. In the future, I plan to cover some of the Proverbs and then go back and get some more of the Psalms, then jump ahead and get Ecclesiastes, and then go back and get some Psalms, and then go back to Proverbs and back to Psalms. That way you don't get too many Proverbs all at once or too many Psalms all at once. But I'd like to get through the Song of Solomon for several reasons, hopefully tonight. There are some books that take the Song of Solomon. Most of the Protestants would allegorize the Song of Solomon and have it the future relationship between Christ the bride, or Christ the husband, and the church the bride. So they spiritualize it away in a sense. In the early days, some of the Jewish scholars hesitated to accept the Song of Solomon into the canon of Scripture because they thought it was kind of embarrassing and kind of blunt and nasty or a little bit crass. Maybe in a way it shows how much of a realist God is that he could write a book like this and have it put in the Bible. And perhaps the first thing you're going to notice when you go through the book is the conflict that our modern world's way of teaching about marriage, about husband and wife, about courtship, about male and female, how opposite it is from the way it was back in the days of Solomon. It's kind of shocking to think the world today can be so advanced and so educated and so civilized and so cultured. And yet, in a lot of ways, they don't have the bare simple knowledge that some of the people back in the old days had. Maybe I can illustrate that with this one example back in Samuel. 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel 16, not 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel 16. And we'll skip over a part of the story here to verse 13. After God has picked the man to be the next king over Israel, and verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed David in the midst of his brethren. The Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. So right after God had Samuel anoint David as the next king, of course God tested his loyalty immediately and whether he would take matters into his own hands or wait on God to make him the king. So notice verse 14, but the Spirit of the Eternal departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Eternal troubled him. Now, it'd be interesting to read that verse in some of the modern commentaries, because they'd have you believe this was just mental frustration or mental anguish or mental worry, or, of course, the Sadducees in Christ's day wouldn't believe this the way it's written either. A couple of things in the translation aren't very plain here. The Spirit of the Eternal, the verb says, in departing, was departing. So it isn't as if it just happened all at once. Bang, you had it, and then bang, you didn't. But what it's saying is that as God's Spirit was departing, it continued departing. Now, it says an evil spirit, and more accurately translated, a melancholy spirit, because there are very many different kinds of spirits. Mr. Armstrong said years ago in a conference, there are probably as many varied kinds of spirits in the spirit world as there are humans in the human world. So you have some spirits that are melancholy spirits, some that are violent spirits, some that are unclean spirits, some that are deaf and dumb spirits. Now, of course, in our day, it's not scholarly, it's not educated, it's not very smart to believe in such things. We're too smart to believe that there's any such thing. In fact, Satan has the world believing he doesn't even exist. But anyway, a melancholy spirit. Now, the reason it said from the eternal, in the Bible sense, if God doesn't prevent something from happening, then it can be said he allowed it, so it's from him. So you'll find that in many other examples as well as this. God didn't stick an unclean spirit on Saul at all. God removed the hedge about him, the protection, and once he did that, then this spirit didn't find enough of God's spirit there to ward it off, so it started troubling him. Notice, it didn't possess him, it troubled him. Or terrified, as the verb's translated other places. Now notice what happened. Well, Saul's servant said, we better get the psychiatrist and the psychologist and the medical staff and let them analyze him and see what's the matter with him. No. Look what happened. Saul's servants said unto him, behold now, an evil spirit from God troubles you. How about that for discernment? Just his servants. The gardener and the chauffeur and the carpenter and the whoever they were, you know, all these various servants of Saul knew right away what the problem was. And yet we've become so advanced and so educated and so sophisticated, and we don't even know such things today. But even Saul's servants knew what happened. And not only did they know what happened, they knew the solution. Notice what happens. Saul's servant said to him, behold now, an evil spirit, a melancholy spirit from God, troubles you. Let our Lord now command your servants, which are before you, to seek out a man who's a cunning player on a harp, and it'll come to pass, when the evil spirit from God is upon you, then he'll play with his hand and you'll be well. Now that can't be. That surely wouldn't work. You know, that seems too simple. But it's really the key that you remove the cause and the effect leaves. You find out why it's able to be there in the first place and eliminate that, and it can't be there. So, you know, they can't just decide who they want to pursue any day and then start pursuing them. You have to open the door for them by allowing particular weaknesses that are in their nature, whether temper or moods or passion or whatever, for them to be able to bother you. Well, let's see if it worked. Verse 19, Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me David your son. David came to Saul, verse 21, stood before him. He loved him greatly. Verse 22, Saul sent to Jesse, let David, I pray you, stand before me, because he's found favor in my sight. Well, it came to pass when this spirit from God was upon Saul. It didn't possess him, but it just came and went. This spirit was able to trouble him when he was moody and depressed and despondent and dejected and negative and downcast. Now, what if you change that and cheer him up and cause him to be happy and inspired and singing and positive? Then what would happen? Well, when this spirit from God was upon Saul, David took a harp, played with his hand, some real moving, inspiring, marching, powerful type melody. Notice the key. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed. So if you eliminate the cause, they're not going to be able to stay around and cause any trouble. So with a melancholy spirit, if the people themselves don't let themselves get swallowed up with overmuch sorrow or moody or depressed or despondent, then no melancholy spirit could ever bother them. And yet in our day, who would ever venture to offer that kind of knowledge to a state hospital or to the board of psychiatrists or, nobody dare do that. They'd think you're nuttier than a fruitcake, you know. They'd think you're crazy if you did that. Well, the Song of Solomon reveals the reality or the frankness or the openness of God. And maybe if man were more open about the things of male and female and marriage and sex, you know, Mr. Armstrong, God's apostle, has written the missing dimension in sex, which is very explicit and very frank and very open. Now, the Song of Solomon is not only God's marriage manual, it's actually a picture of two people that are perfectly mated, that have a perfect example of give and take in marriage, a man and wife in marriage, but it also has a lesson for the young people that if they want to have this ideal, perfect kind of a marriage, then they have to wait to the right time and the right person comes along as well. So you'll see a message again and again through the book, Daughters of Jerusalem. Now, interestingly enough, doesn't have anything similar to say to the sons of Jerusalem or the young men of Jerusalem. So the lesson, as far as the young people, is addressed to the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, in the way the world pictures marriage, it says man is the aggressor. It says man always has to be the one that is expressive and the sweet talker. You know, the man plays the ukulele under the girlfriend's balcony and serenades her, and man eulogizes the woman and gives all kinds of sweet talk to the woman. And yet, in contrast, if you ever saw a woman playing a ukulele under a man's window and sweet-talking a man and giving him all kinds of love talk, you know, you'd think, well, what in the world's going on here anyway? Now, the world has become so warped. I remember a young girl in one church area where I was, and they were planning on getting married, and I was talking with the two of them together about marriage and about sex and marriage, as Mr. Armstrong instructed us to do as ministers. And after church on a Sabbath, she asked if she could talk with me a little bit. She had a few questions, and I said, fine. So she was saying, you know, after I'm married, I feel like I'd like to, if my husband's wrapped up in paying bills or doing things that are very distasteful to him, I'd like to just go down and pull his desk chair out and sit in his lap and hug him and kiss him. And said at other times when he's under pressure or doing something he doesn't enjoy doing, I just like to run down and hug his head between my breasts. And she said, but I'd be afraid to. She said, I'd be afraid to. I'd be afraid he'd think, boy, oh boy, what kind of a girl did I marry here anyway, you know? And, she's forward and bold, and I felt sorry for her that she would have that desire to be that expressive toward a man, and she'd be afraid to do it. Now, I've counseled a lot of people about marriage, and I've seen a lot of men who've been starved for a woman who will talk love to them. So when I read through the Song of Solomon and studied it and researched it and marked it, the first thing that dumbfounded me was that the woman said as much as the man did. That as I marked it in my Bible, it's half red and half blue. And the blue's when I get to talk, and the red's when my wife has to talk. And she has as much to say about me and loving me and romancing me as I do her. And yet I imagine most of you saw the movie, The Fiddler on the Roof, and you saw the couple who'd been married 24 years, and the man, a real fiery, vigorous, active, lovable man, and a hard-working, respectable real kind, decent wife, two lovable people, and yet he said, well, Golda, do you love me? And, of course, she said, well, I've washed your clothes and fixed your meals and raised your kids and slopped your pigs and done this and that. And after she finished that, he just waited a few seconds, and then he said, yes, but, Golda, do you love me? And she said, why, we've been through thick and thin together, and we've been through trials, and she rattled off a lot more things. And after she got through, he just waited a minute and said, yes, but, Golda, do you love me? And then she said, well, they told me I might learn to love you. And, you know, that just stabbed me right through the heart. I just put my place in the place of that man who'd been married 24 years. 24 years he'd been married, and she never was able to say, I sure love you, you big lug, you know, and you're sure desirable to me, and, you know, I don't have any interest in anybody else. You're it for me, and... Well, Satan's done a good job brainwashing our world and duping us into thinking expressiveness is sissy, or tears are sissy, or apologizing isn't macho or manly. And well, the Song of Solomon is Holy Scripture. I was talking to one of the men on the refresher program. We had a marriage counseling session today, and he said, well, how do you approach giving a marriage class if some of the people in it are going to get offended if you read the Song of Solomon? And I said, well, I guess you just have to work it somehow where you can lead up to it and then give it anyway. I guess if anybody would get offended at the Song of Solomon, they've already been offended at Mr. Armstrong's book anyway, so... You know, why worry that much about it? Now, right away in church or in a marriage class, when you start to go through the Song of Solomon, everybody that's already been married, that's not going to be married, turns off their hearing aid and says, well, that's not for me. I'm not going to get married. Well, you're going to be a marriage counselor for 1,000 years. You know, I don't care whether you're married right now or not. You're going to be a marriage counselor for 1,000 years. And you're going to need to be able to sit down with couples in the millennium and let them know how to have a better marriage. So it doesn't make any difference whether you're 18 or whether you're 88. It doesn't make any difference whether you've never been married or whether you've been married 3 or 4 times. Or, you know, that doesn't make any difference. Anytime anybody gives a sermon on child rearing, don't tune out because your kids are all grown and gone away from home. You know, you're going to be training people in how to train their children for 1,000 years. So you're going to need all those sermons you can get. Well, let's go ahead in the Song of Solomon so we can finish it this evening, hopefully. But the Song of Songs, of course, that means out of the 1,500 songs that Solomon wrote, you might notice 1 Kings chapter 4. Kings chapter 4, verse 29, God gave Solomon wisdom, understanding exceeding much, largeness of heart, even as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all men, Ethan the Ezrahite, Heman. Of course, these are some of the men that wrote some of the Psalms. So in God's judgment, they're some of the wisest men in the world in that day. And yet Solomon's wisdom exceeded theirs, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all nations round about. And he spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. So out of 3,000 proverbs, you just have the ones he has in the book of Proverbs. And out of the 1,005 songs, only one was appropriate to make the scriptures. And the way people feel about the one that did make the scriptures, you might wonder what would happen if they read the ones that didn't make the scriptures, if they heard those songs. But out of 1,005 songs, this is the song of 1,005 songs, which were Solomon's. Now, right away, the first one to speak is the woman. Now, I wonder why God did that. That isn't normal. The man ought to be the first one to speak about the woman. But God likes to shock people, you know, in their human education and thinking. So right away, the woman says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is better than wine." Now, some people analyze kissing scientifically and say it's unhealthy. We'd be better off like Eskimos rubbing noses and all kinds of various analysis of kissing. But in God's sight, the song is very much full of that. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, because your love is better than wine. So in that day, one of the highlight comparisons was a real top-quality wine as far as how warm it is and how healthy and how life-giving. And so that's the way a husband's kiss ought to be to his wife. You know, I've refereed family arguments where a man would say, "Well, I'm always kissing her. She never kisses me." And I just say, "Well, how do you do that, you know? How can you kiss her and she not kissing you? That's kind of hard to do, you know. It looks to me like you're kissing her, she's kissing you." But they want to hassle about who initiated the kissing, you know. "I'm always going to kiss her." Well, try that without her sometime. But notice, he says, "Your love is better than wine because of the savor of your good ointments." Now, can you imagine that? A woman talking about a man's aftershave. Talking about a man's deodorant and his... "Because of the savor of your good ointments." Now, she likens the uplifting, refreshing, fragrant smell of the perfume or whatever to his name. "Your name is as ointment poured forth." Just to mention your name. You know, right away, the first thing you'd think about would be some stock and bond company that when they speak, everybody listens. Well, what about your husband's name? And what does the name mean? If somebody speaks your name, what does it bring to mind? What does it suggest? Quality, culture, dignity, hard work. "Your name is as ointment poured forth." You know, wouldn't it be great that our minds were so full of Scripture when somebody walked into the room with a nice, sweet aftershave or perfume, we'd think, "Boy, that's just like a good name." "Therefore, do the virgins love you?" So now right away it brings in the fact that this husband's desirable to others as well. He was the catch of the crop, you might say. He was the one other girls were interested in. Now, that shows one trait of human nature that's detestable to me, and that is, for some reason, a man might not be desirable to a girl at all unless other girls are interested in him, and then she is too. Now, I can't figure that out. You know, I was going with my wife, and I came home all the way from A&M one time, and she wasn't there. And she didn't bother to let me know that she wasn't going to be there. She was at Oklahoma visiting kin folks. So I got there, and she wasn't there, and I thought, well, boy, oh boy, you know, that kind of upset me no end. So I thought, well, I'll just go with somebody else. She takes me for granted that way, you know, thinks she got you on the string, so nobody else is interested in you, so they don't worry about you. Just put you out on the string, you know. And see, I fell head over heels for my wife first. A lot of other cases, it's the other way around. You know, it's rare I've ever seen God let two people fall for each other at the same rate. And I wonder why God does that. You know, you can pray and ask God to provide you the right mate and do that all your life, and yet, sure as the world, one of you is going to flip for the other one before the other one cares about the other one at all. You know, Jim Friddle was chasing his wife here on the campus, and she couldn't stand him, you know. So she went to Mrs. Armstrong, and she said, "How do you get this guy off your neck, you know? How do you get rid of this guy, you know? He's he's like a plague, you know. He's always there, always around. And how do I get rid of this guy? Of course, she hadn't been rid of him for about 20 years. She's been married to him. But I don't know what it is about human nature that makes girls want someone that others want. If others don't want somebody, then they don't care either, you know. Well, that isn't the way it ought to be, you know. That's just carnality. But when my wife came back and found out I'd gone with somebody else, boy, you know, right away, she couldn't take me for granted, so she was interested in me right quick, you know. I don't ever use that as psychology. Don't ever do that on purpose, because that isn't right to do. Anyway, notice what happens. Here you find this man was desirable to all the young ladies. Therefore do the virgins love you, the daughters of Jerusalem. Draw me, we'll run after you. My king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice. We will remember your love more than wine. The upright love you. So here, he was a very upright person, very upstanding, very strong character, the king. So his position was also attractive and desirable. And now, that's the end of the statements of the woman. Now the man starts talking. I am black but comely, O you daughters of Jerusalem. So the word black there is not the word for the black crayon or the black color. It just means dusky or dark. Real dark olive colored from the heredity and also from the sun there. So he says, I'm swarthy or dusky or dark but comely, O you daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon. Look not upon me because I'm swarthy, because the sun has looked upon me. My mother's children were angry with me. Now, some of these are symbolical of Christ and the way his brothers of Judah treated him when he was here. So a part of it you can get a duality in, but you don't want to spiritualize it away and lose the physical meaning of the perfect marriage picture between a man and a woman. So here it could symbolically be talking about how Christ was when he was going to have to die and when he was when his, the son of tribulation or wrath had come back upon him and his mother's children, the other Jews, were angry with him. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but mine own vineyard I've not kept. They said, well, you may be a prophet, or you may be a, but you're not the Messiah. So they would allow that he would be a keeper of another vineyard, but not of his own vineyards. So they rejected him in that sense. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where you feed, where you make your flock to rest at noon. For why should I be as one that turns aside by the flocks of your companions? So here's the longing for the lover while he's out tending the flock and wondering, thinking about him during the day, where he is and where the flock is. And if you know not, O you fairest among women, go the way forth of the footsteps of the flock. So here again, a man speaking to his wife. What if the husband always referred to his wife as, O you fairest among women? You know, you don't have to lie and say you're the only beautiful girl in the world, or, you know, you're the fairest among women. Everything considered, you're the fairest. You're the one I desire and delight in and love. Go your way forth of the footsteps of the flock and feed your kids beside the shepherd's tents. I have compared you, O my love, to a company of horses in Pharaoh's chariots. Now, you know, you may not dig that kind of language in the modern world, but when you think about the dignity and the class, the sophisticated chariots of Pharaoh with these prancing, strutting, beautifully decorated horses, then you could compare a lassie with a real rosy cheeks and real vigor and real pace in her step, and that's a beautiful comparison. Your cheeks are comely with rose, your neck with chains of gold. We will make you borders of gold with studs of silver. So for some reason, God's made women where they enjoy adding to their natural beauty by framing it with jewelry and things like that. And it isn't natural for most men to be wearing a lot of jewelry. But the woman's not limited to just the physical, natural beauty. The Song of Solomon, God allows the adding to the natural beauty. But you know, it's like having a beautiful picture. If the frame is twice as big as the picture, and the frame costs four times as much as the picture, people would kind of shake their head and think, well, that's done there. Look at that. It's ridiculous. And that's the same way if the adorning supplants or cancels out or takes the place of the natural beauty there. That isn't the way God meant for it to be. So he talks about the cheeks and the beauty of the cheeks and the neck. And we'll make you borders of gold with studs of silver. Now, after he's talked about what he wants to do for this fairest of women, she answers back in verse 12. So now you start having the woman speaking. While the king, or my king, sits at his table, my spikenard sends forth the smell thereof. So here she's the first lady, and she has a culture and a dignity and a class and a quality befitting a first lady. So while the king sits at his table, my spikenard sends forth the smell thereof. A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night between my breasts. Now that doesn't suggest twin beds, you know. And that doesn't suggest king-sized beds or queen-sized beds or whatever, as far as staying away from one another. Now, God is very plain-spoken. I read the Reader's Digest series they had, I Am Joe's Stomach, I Am Joe's Intestines, and I Am Joe's this and that. And they had one that was I Am Betty or Mary's Breast, and they described what a breast is, you know, that it's almost totally fat tissue. And they talked about how ignorant people are to worship a bundle of fat tissue. And, you know, they likened the... They talked about how the Western world tends to be a nation of bosom worshipers, and they, you know, they compared the attitude of French and people in Scandinavia to the Western world. But God is very plain spoken, you know. God intended the breast to be a part of the love play in marriage. They're not just glands for nursing children with only. So God made them attractive and desirable, but they're all a part of the marriage. But notice, the woman isn't, she doesn't have a false modesty. She doesn't have an attitude that, you know, sex is for the man and romance and all that's the man. He's the aggressor and he's the one that's supposed to be giving all the sweet talk. And maybe that's how people get in trouble, you know. If both parties were equally expressive, then maybe girls couldn't get swept off their feet by some guy giving them sweet talk. You know, I couldn't help the other day sitting in a restaurant and heard this guy's long line of lies that he was rattling off to this girl, and I felt like jumping in and saying, hey, you better watch that guy. He's just giving you a long line of talk, and you're headed for trouble if you believe in all that. But I minded my own business. I remembered to grab a passing dog by the ears. so I didn't want to do that. But you know, God is a realist, and God is very plain spoken. You know, back in 1 Corinthians, God says to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife. Now, that scripture horrifies a lot of people. They think, well, really, that's not much grounds to get married on. Well, that's true. But all other factors considered, you know, there may be a time people need to get married and ought to get married and not just try to wait a length of time for an ideal or wait at a certain age. You know, Mr. Armstrong said the ideal age for marriage is 24, 25. We've had some ministers take that as a law, and they wouldn't marry anybody unless they were up in those ages. Well, that contradicts that scripture where Paul said, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife. So God is very realistic, you know. God isn't an idealist. God is a perfectionist, but God is a realist. So notice the royal setting of a banquet, the king sitting at his table, the first lady sitting there with her apparel and her sweet smell, and then she's thinking about keeping her husband satisfied at home. He shall lie all night between my breasts. And my husband's like a bundle of myrrh, well beloved. My beloved is unto me as the cluster of camphor, or cypress, in the vineyards of Ongedi. Very fragrant, very desirable to hang in your house. A lot more valuable than mistletoe. Behold your fair, my love. Behold your fair. You have dove's eyes. Behold your fair, my beloved. Yea, pleasant also. Our bed is green. The beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters of fir. Now, when you think about husbands and wives being that expressive and that dignified around each other, I remember years ago Mr. Armstrong used to always say, don't let down the dignity in your marriage. Don't let down too much around one another. Don't become too familiar around one another. And somehow when educated men are sitting in a faculty locker room and they see who can outbelch one another, I'm glad wives aren't there. In fact, I wish I wasn't there when they do that. But somehow people seem to think that to let down all dignity and let down all culture, you know, that's one of the curses of our society. You see the way people run around undressed. You couldn't call it running around dressed. They're running around undressed. They don't know there's a certain place to wear certain things, you know. Anything that's comfortable, wear anywhere you please. Hang everybody else. Don't worry about anybody else. Just be comfortable. Well, that's the curse of society, to not maintain a certain dignity. You know, that's one thing I highly respect about the older British people and the older French people. They maintain a certain dignity. They don't degenerate things and let things go to the rock bottom like Americans do and Scandinavians do. Well, the woman says of her husband, you're fair, my love. You have dove's eyes. You're fair, my beloved. Yea, pleasant. What a green bed we have. Now, what is that all about, you know? Well, it's like being in a garden of greenery around you, shrubs and flowers and trees, and it suggests life and beauty and fragrance and quality and culture and dignity. The beams of our house are cedar, the choicest, the high quality, the proof of real care for one another. And yet right in the middle of all of this dignity and culture, she talks about how she keeps her husband satisfied at home. And she doesn't have a false modesty. She knows that God made the female figure attractive to the man, and so she isn't shy about keeping her husband satisfied at home. Now, in chapter 2, Here the man says, I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Well, then the wife answers back. She didn't say, well, listen, old braggart there, you know, I'm the rose of Sharon and the hill and the lily of the valleys. You know, she just shied it in and said, that's right, you really are. As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. So here again, the beautiful apple blossoms, the beautiful apple, you know, the old saying, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And they've had clippings out in the newspapers proving not only does an apple today keep the doctor away, but also the dentist. And they've entitled articles that way. You know, an apple is an unusual fruit. You wonder why they talk about the apple in the Garden of Eden. And of course, they say that's where they get the name Adam's apple, for that lump in your throat. That the apple stuck in Adam's throat, he shouldn't have eaten. And so they call it an Adam's apple. Well, it might not have been an apple in the tree, or in the Garden of Eden in the tree, but when you think about an apple, it's one of the great foods that God created. You know, the things in an apple polish your teeth. The things in an apple, you can raise your blood pressure 10 degrees in 1 week by just eating about 5 or 6, 7 apples a day. I've done that, you know, in 1 week. A woman that has difficulty with a monthly cycle, by taking a little bit of apple cider vinegar in her water, can regulate and get things adjusted right out to perfect clockwork. There's something in the apple, you know, that is unique in the fruits. So God highlights the apple tree. And that's the way this man is to this wife. He's like the apple tree among the other trees, oak trees or various other trees that don't equal the apple tree in what it produces. That's the way my beloved is among sons. Now, she likens her husband's providing for her and protecting her. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. In other words, my husband's an excellent provider. He really takes pride in providing for his family. It is an insult to him to suggest that his family doesn't have what they need. Now, I don't know how many men have had their feelings cut to the bone by wives not appreciating what a man's able to provide or suggesting that a man's a sorry provider. Now, you know, that hurts a man very deeply.
God says if a man doesn't provide for his own, he's denied the faith and he's worse than an infidel. Well, that's one of the strongest scriptures in the Bible. So how many women take the time to express appreciation like this for a husband, like a tree, like an apple tree, that since they've been married to, it's like sitting down under the shadow, the protection, the care and the provision of a husband, like an apple tree. With great delight they've sat under his shadow, and his provision, his nourishment, his house clothing that he's provided for her was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house. His banner over me was love. That was our victory banner. That was the marriage banner, love. He loved to bring me to the banqueting house. You know, when you love somebody and you see something, you can't wait to take them to see it. When you experience something new, you can't wait to take them to do it. And that's what she's saying even here. He brought me to the banqueting house. Our marriage has just been a banquet. And the banner has been love. Now she says, sustain me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. Now, that seems to be a direct flip back from what she's been saying before. Now, of course, what she's saying here in the physical sense is, sustain me with raisin cakes and revive me with apples. Now, of course, you can analyze the Bible dietary-wise, and it is right on the nose. God knows what He created in various foods. So when you need to be revived, you need to be enriching your blood, you need to be revitalizing your red corpuscles or whatever, you can't beat raisin cakes to do it with. When you need to be revived from low blood pressure or draggy, listless, lack of natural sugar to have any vigor, revive yourself with apples. Sustain yourself with raisin cakes. Now, apparently what she's saying here is, when she looks around and sees everybody else always talking about love and always talking about romance and always talking about the right person and marriage, and she's sick of hearing all of this about love, and maybe that verse is a lot more true today. When you have a happy marriage and you're living in a world today, you could say, boy, I'm sick of all this love. People talk about love and they advocate love and they try to tell you what love is and they don't know it all. Now, she goes on back to her bragging about how she keeps her husband captivated in her way. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand does embrace me. Now, this woman is bragging about her husband and how much he desires to have her in his arms, how much he desires to hold her. You know, the people end up married too long for that, and they don't like to have someone have their left hand under their head and their right hand embracing them. Now, notice the lesson she gives in verse 7. Apparently, going back to the last part of verse 5, I charge you, I adjure you, O you daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that you stir not up nor awake. And you notice, my is italicized there. The writers would have you believe this is just talking about the bride, the wife, saying, don't wake up my lover until he's ready to be awakened. And that isn't what it's saying at all. That's trivia. That'd be ridiculous. You know, who cares that much about somebody being awakened from one nap too soon? What she's saying here is, if you really want to have a perfect marriage, and you really want to have someone that cares about you like this king did for her, if you want your marriage to be a continuing banquet and to have the banner of love over your marriage, then don't awake love before the time. Don't stir up your nature. Don't get your nature aroused and excited, and don't go around thinking and talking about love and marriage and family and children, and don't awaken love till the right person comes along. God will provide the right person, but in the meantime, you're charged and adjured by the perfect wife as counsel to someone who'd also like to have a perfect marriage as she did, not to awaken love in your nature, not to get your nature all aroused and get worked up in love until God brings the right person along. Now, after giving that charge or that admonition to the daughters of Jerusalem, she goes back talking about her husband coming again. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. Oh, he can't wait to get back home. You know, he's been out with the flock, and boy, the path to the home is beautiful. He can't wait to get back. you know, he's not trying to find an excuse to get away from home. He's not trying to find an excuse to stay away from home. He has to make himself stay away. His job keeps him away. But boy, when it's time to go back home, he comes leaping upon the mountains and skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a roe or a young hart. Of course, if you've seen the lively, bouncy vigor of the deer family, then you know what she's talking about here. The guy's got a real pace in his step, a real vigor and kick in his step, like a roe or a young hart. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He looks forth at the windows, showing himself through the lattice. So apparently he likes to watch his wife when she's not noticing it. And he likes to just surprise her when he comes back and not let her know he's back and just watch her because she's beautiful to watch to him. My beloved spake and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. Not the voice of a turtle. You know, he'd be out of place there anyway with flowers and singing birds. And the fig tree puts forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, come away. In other words, let's take a romantic walk through the flowers and the springtime plants and the beauty of the creation of God. I've been away for a while with the flocks. Now let's take our walking and revive our love and soak up our absence from one another. And verse 14, O my dove that are in the clefts of the rock. Now, in some of these verses, there could be a parallel with the church, the bride, waiting for Christ to come, because there are scriptures that would say, like verse 8, could be a story of the Advent. So I've just marked Advent in the margin there, because here's the voice of Christ when he comes back, and he's going to come back leaping upon the mountains and skipping upon the hills. And also verse 10, my beloved is going to spake and say, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Now, that's not the rapture like the Baptists teach and the Protestants. That's a good rapture verse to them, but that isn't what he's saying here. God is going to take his bride-to-be to a place of security and provide for her and make her secure, like any husband is to do for a wife. So verse 10 is also talking about how Christ is going to deal with his bride, the church. Also verse 13, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. So the church is beautiful to Christ and going to be secured and fed and loved in a place of security. Verse 14 could well be talking about Petra or any rock security for the bride. O my dove that are in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs, let me see your countenance. Let me hear your voice, for sweet is your voice, and your countenance is comely. Now, in a way, that's the way a husband ought to feel toward his wife. Very protective. He really enjoys hearing her voice when it's sweet. He enjoys her countenance and her companionship and her presence. And yet it's also talking about the church to Christ. Now in verse 15, take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. And apparently here he's talking about the children being protected along with the mother, and not just the mother only. Verse 16, the wife starts talking again. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He feeds among the lilies until the day break, and the shadows flee away. Turn, my beloved, and be like a roe or a young hart. In other words, he's gone back to work now, and he's out taking care of the flocks out in the various locations. He feeds among the lilies, and then she's looking forward to the day that he'll surprise her and come back home and watch her while she's working around without her knowing it, and then surprise her and take their spring walk through the flowers again and the beauty. Until the day break and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved. You be like a roe or young hart. Come back like you did back up there, she read earlier, skipping on the hills and coming like the roe and the hart. Now, chapter 3. By night on my bed I sought him. So here's this bride dreaming about the husband. Now, in our world, you know, it's supposed to be the other way. The man's supposed to idolize the woman and put her up on a pedestal and utter all kinds of flatteries toward her. But here's the woman having a desire for a husband. And, you know, up until our generation, the last few generations, for a woman to admit that a man was desirable to her, for a woman to look on a man in the physical sense, well, you know, people would have thought that woman was just really weird. And yet, right in the Song of Solomon, it talks about that all the time. The man should be just as desirable to the woman as the woman is to the man. Maybe God made a man differently, where his attractiveness to a woman is different, and a woman's attractiveness to a man is different, but they should both be there. So here she is, thinking about her husband, lying on her bed. By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not. So she's dreaming or having a nightmare that he's not there, that he's gone. I will rise now and go about the city and the streets and the broadways. I'll seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not. You know, a lot of times people have repeating dreams where maybe they'll dream about losing their wife or losing their husband. And they worry in a dream, and then they awake the next morning, and boy, they're so glad it isn't real, you know. They're relieved that it was only a nightmare, and there's their wife or husband still right there, and you love them more than you ever would have if you hadn't had the nightmare that you lost them. But here she is thinking about what life would be like without her husband. The watchmen that go about the city found me, to whom I said, saw you him whom my soul loves? So her love is open, you know. Her love wasn't secret. It wasn't hidden. Everybody knew about it. So even the watchman, she just said, you've seen him whom my soul loves? And they'd have probably said, well, lady, come on, who are you talking about? You think everybody knows who your soul loves? Well, apparently she didn't mind telling everybody, you know. She just, because she couldn't hide it. It was obvious. It was there all the time. So she just said to these watchmen, saw you him whom my soul loves? It was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. Now, this may be a picture before they were married, or it could be a repeated picture after they're married. But you notice again the balance of aggressiveness on the woman's part. She didn't hesitate a bit to say that she found him whom her soul loves and held him and wouldn't let him go. And she didn't worry about whether he was holding her and wouldn't let her go, you know. She was talking about how much she needed him and wanted him and how much he was appreciated and how dear he was to her. I wouldn't let him go until I brought him into my mother's house. You know, that's one thing I've always urged people to do before they ever marry anybody. And that is, go spend some time with the family. You're marrying someone who came out of an environment of 20 years, so you better find out what the environment was they came out of for 20 years, because people can write a pretty story, and people can tell a pretty story, but if you don't really know
You know, I've had people come up later and say, well, I'll tell you, if I'd have known, you know, I guess their environment finally overtook them, and boy, if I'd have known that'd been their environment, I'd have never married them. And I just say, well, that's ignorance, not fraud. You know, why didn't you know? You know, if you tried to find out and no one allowed you to, if you tried to find out and people kept it from you, you know, that's fraud. But failure to find out, that's not fraud. That's Russian roulette. You know, that's taking chances and making a mistake. So anytime I'm going to counsel people about marriage, I'm going to be sure they've met each other's family and they've been to each other's home environment and they've spent a little while there so they could get acquainted with the family. And now, it doesn't say they twain shall be four, you know. You don't marry the family, so that part isn't accurate either. But to think you don't, that someone isn't the product of their heredity and environment, you know, I would trust seeing the heredity environment more than I would my own emotion or feelings towards somebody. Boy, you can really get duped there. Oh, I don't know, you know, before I married my wife, I took a close scrutiny of her mom. I don't know why, nobody ever told me to, or I never was taught that. I'm glad I did, you know, because I knew my wife would grow up to be like her mom, and that was great for, with me, you know. I was hoping that'd be the case. So, but notice the admonition here. If this is the picture before they were married, she wanted to be sure that this guy that swept her off her feet, that was so desirable, so position of power, a king, an heir apparent, that they wanted to be sure that they weren't being duped or misled, so she brought him into her mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. She's the one that gave birth to me. I'm a part of her. I came out of her. She must know me. So she's going to have some good input on there. Well, when you elope, you eliminate that chance. No wonder marriages fail, you know. If people followed the guidelines, you'd have a lot better chance. Now notice verse 5. After having had this nightmare of losing her husband-to-be or her husband, she's got another message for these other young virgins that are all wrapped up in love. They're in love with love. They're in love with marriage. And boy, do you ever get a lot of those at college. You know, when students used to come into the office in Big Sandy, I didn't say this, I felt like it sometimes, and I said, well, now which one of these three is your problem? There's always one of three things. But I didn't do that. I just wait and let them tell me which one of the three it was. But notice what he says here. I charge you, O you daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field. Now, in other words, what has been said so far about the rose and the hinds of the field? Well, that's how frolicky and how lively her husband is when he comes back to her all the time. That's what's been said about them. So he's saying, or she's saying here, if you want a husband that's that captivated with you, that can't wait to get home to you, that comes frolicking across the hilltops like a hart or a roe, oh, you daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, don't stir up your nature. Don't let your nature get stirred up in passion and love and romance and craving for marriage. Don't awaken love till the right person comes along. Save all that for your husband. Save all that for the right man that God brings along for you later. Now imagine how much great teaching you miss on by putting those italicized my's in there. That's how prudish those old 1611 guys were. Now I can just see them blushing even when they translated some of the Song of Solomon. So if they could put a my in there and make it a little less blunt, they would. Well, that was a lesson for the virgins, the young people that weren't quite mature enough for marriage yet, that love marriages. For some reason, little girls
from the time they're real small. They just love marriages. And boys can't stand them, you know. We had to draft our son when he was little into being a ring bearer and the flower boy, and the biggest relief in his life was when it was over with. Now, he just hated to do that. The girls just love standing around and look at girls in bridal gowns and see all that falter all going on. And so all the way through here, the charge is daughters of Jerusalem. Be careful that you don't get caught up in romance and love and desire for love and marriage before the time. Wait, put it off. Keep yourself. And then you can just captivate a husband and have him so caught up in you that he'll come skipping on the mountains like the roe in the hart. Now, verse 6. Who is this that comes out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold his bed, which is Solomon's. 70 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. King Solomon made himself a chariot, or here's the same word bed again as up above, of the wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it of purple, the midst thereof having paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O you daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon with the crown, wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals, and in the day of the gladness of his heart. In other words, take a good look at a king and the stately royal beauty and culture and quality of a king. And if you want to be married in a marriage like that and have your king, then wait the time. Wait till he comes. But here she just pictured the glory of Solomon's presence or Solomon's palace and bedroom and home and guard and